Here we go again, it's the game we love.
Play game.
Keep our minds on the game.
All the game.
You are listening to KBOO Community Radio, and this is Winner's Bias, America's first, best, and only board game radio show.
Until proven otherwise.
A show about board games and showing your friends the best and worst of yourself. I'm your host, Nate, and with me is my buddy, James. How are you, James?
I'm doing all right, thanks. You know, just trying to keep warm in this cold weather that's creeping in.
Yeah, it occurred to me, I say I am your host, and I feel like that's knocking you down a peg. Do that.
I mean, that's all you do. That's the only reason I'm here, so you can knock me down some pegs.
Ooh, I think I might need to switch mics here in a moment. Do you hear this in the headphones?
I do.
Yeah, I think I might need to switch mics, so we're going to transition real quick. James, do you want to introduce our guest while I do that?
All right, we're here today with Ned Damon, who is the Portland local playtest organizer for Break My Game. He runs a playtest event at Guardian Games on the third Sunday of every month. Ned is also the host of the podcast The Force Unlimited, about the card trading card game Star Wars Unlimited. Welcome to the show, Ned.
Glad to be here. It's a real honor.
Yeah, how are you doing today?
I'm doing all right. The cold is funny. I was talking to somebody from Poland, and I was complaining about the cold, and they're like, so how cold was it? And I said, well, it's like 0 Celsius, and they go, it's 20 below here. And it's zero sympathy.
This is cold for us.
Alright, I'm going to see how we're doing over here. Alright, this one's on okay, but it might be James'
mic. It might be my microphone.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
We'll have to do a musical chairs running around in a second.
Just dancing around the studio.
Do you want to go back to that one and I'll run to that one?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right.
You're not getting to see this. Imagine the Benny Hill theme. That's for James right there. That's a reference for James. Alright, I'm not on. Alright, yeah, it was definitely James. James, you're always screwing things up. All right, Ned, well, now that we're getting ourselves situated here like the professionals that we are, why don't you go ahead and tell us how and when you got in the hobby, and was there a game that hooked you?
So I'm kind of a heritage gamer, I suppose, where my dad was deep into Lord of the Rings, and so I played a lot of various Lord of the Rings games. I remember playing War of the Ring with him back in the day. And I think that was probably where I kind of first got bitten, but I got deeply invested in the hobby. In graduate school, I played a lot of Friedman Fries's Power Grid with a bunch of grad students, and it was, you know, a good time, and I think that's what kind of snared me.
I was just talking yesterday, I've never played a Friedman Fries's game, and I feel like he's so ubiquitous that... like, I should have played at least one by now.
I feel like he's a generation ago. He's the Catan, maybe, of, like, 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Gen X of the game designers.
Awesome. So how did you find your first gaming group?
Well, I was in grad school with a bunch of nerds going to grad school in physics. Unsurprisingly, there's a lot of people who are interested in, you know, RPGs and board games. And then since then, I've moved around a fair bit. And I've generally used the internet, forums, discords, etc., to try and find like-minded folks wherever I end up.
Fantastic.
Yeah, but your favorite game, or one you think that everyone should try?
So,
getting started.
I don't think that everyone should try this. This is my personal favorite game, and it's Sidereal Confluence. So it's a 4-to-8 player game where the mechanics are you turn cubes into more cubes, and then you trade your cubes with other people. And sometimes the cubes are octagons, but it's really fascinating because it's a purely positive sum trading game where you're trying to help everybody else out, and you're not trying to shark the deals necessarily. It's just like pure positive sum, good vibes trading, but it's like 4-to-8 people for a couple of hours where you're just turning cubes into more cubes, and then you're swapping your cubes for different cubes.
A cube for cube game.
Yeah.
That's one I've wanted to try for the longest time.
It's really good. I do recommend the new edition of it. The old edition is aggressively low production value.
I've just realized that every time when someone comes in and says about their favorite game or what they think everyone should try, they always have the weirdest names. Board games have weird names.
Well, they either have weird names or the name of a place somewhere in the world.
That's fair. Yeah. I think that's fair.
But yeah, I'm a big fan of the, like, sort of highly interactive, above the table sort of game. So yeah. Like, that one's always appealed to me.
I mean, if you get 4 to 8 players together and you have several hours, strong recommend.
Yeah.
A friendly trading game sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
Usually they're like...
No, they're pretty cutthroat. Yeah, no, yeah. This is why it's one of my favorite games.
Awesome. So, Ned, why don't you tell us about Break My Game? What is it, and what do you do?
So, Break My Game is an originally online community that hosts playtesting events, both online and in person. It's a space for designers to experiment with their games, to try and learn more about game design and how to improve their games as much as possible. It also helps to provide a space where people can understand more about the industry, because something that I've found is that it's kind of like an onion or an ogre or however you want to go, where there's layers, right? Where when you're on the outside, you just, at every stage, you're just looking at the next thing, and the stages beyond are kind of abstract and hard to get your head around until you get there. But because there's so many people in the community and because they're just all over the place, you can really get a sense from people at all different levels about the challenges they're encountering, and then they can help you to advance, to move forward with your designs and kind of get to the next level. And not to hyper name drop here, but Elizabeth Hargrave, designer of Wingspan, is a member of Break My Game. So,
oh, wow.
Awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
And just, we just had a phone call come through, and unfortunately we're in a room with the phone, and so we're not going to answer it. So I don't remember if I mentioned, but you can comment on our website through the OLARC messaging system. If you do have a question that you want, to come in, that would be the best way. Go to kbu.fm and click the, I think it says chat with us right now. And you can get a question in that way. So why is playtesting important?
So there's a book that I like to reference that's called The Wheelwright's Workshop, that is an old book about somebody who was a wheel maker. This is a kind of a wending road to get where we're going. But he was a wheel maker in the pre-industrial era, and he talked about how there were all these different ways of making wheels and types of wheels, and people understood how to make these wheels not because somebody designed them, not because somebody came to them with a diagram, but because this had worked. And like sort of over time, over this cultural evolution, the edges of the wheels, to kind of stretch this analogy, had been worn away to the point where that they were very well suited for specific purposes. And I think that board game design is a lot like that, where if you're approaching it from kind of an overarching, looking at a game, it is hard to understand what parts of the design work and what parts of the design don't. And when you're making a game, it's really hard to understand what parts of the game work and what parts of the game don't without actually doing it, because the big thing about games is that they involve generally more than one person, and they're all making different decisions, and understanding those incentives and understanding how these incentives play with each other is something that is really hard to do when you're just sitting at your table or you're sitting at your computer and you're trying to figure out what to do. So prototyping, playtesting is how you get those edges sanded off and you end up with a game that in the end is fun.
So there's often a thing said when people play a new game,
yeah,
and they're just like, oh, it needed more playtesting.
Yes.
How often do you think that's actually true? And how often do you think it's like, oh, this person's just playing a game once and making assumptions based on a lot of things?
I think it varies. I think that, you know, different designs get different amounts of playtesting. I will say that one of the challenges is that when you're playtesting a game, you are playtesting it maybe at the upper limit, like 100, 200 times. That's 100, 200 times the table. And then once a game gets released, if more than 1,000 people buy it and 10% of them are playing a game, then they've played more games than you have ever played of the game. And so there's all this emergent behavior that can show up. And that's one of the reasons why working from prior art and trying to understand what designs have worked in the past and what makes those designs work helps, because then you're not having to start from first principles, and you're able to kind of leverage the testing and the understanding that has developed among other games and among other games of that type.
I'm guessing that's where this this organization on Break My Game really helps out, because sometimes you might just not like that type of game.
Yes.
So if you get people who don't enjoy your type of game, they're not going to think it's a very good game, or they're going to think it needs more playtesting. But yep. I'm assuming this organization helps bring in so many different types of playtesters that you're going to find people who enjoy your game and will know a bit more about your type of game.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it varies with community. So the local playtesting events, you get people who show up to the local playtesting events, and that's not like a uniform random sample over the space of board gamers. But when you're doing online playtesting and when you're just talking with people through the Discord or through the various events that we hold, you get a wide enough swath of people that I think you really get a lot of benefit and a lot of understanding about people who thought about different kinds of games at different levels and have had a lot of experience. The collective experience is large enough that it really helps to advance your design.
So, like, we kind of understand where the designers come from,
yeah.
But, like, where do the playtesters come from?
That's a little bit tricky. So one of the big things about Break My Game is that everybody's expected to give more than they take. So if you are coming with a design, you are expected to playtest other people's designs as well. You can't just like bring your game and test it. You are expected to help test other designers' games. But I think that there's a lot of people where they're interested in the hobby and they're interested in kind of seeing how the process works. Even if they don't have a game in design right now, they're interested enough in kind of the general hobby and what different people's takes on things are that they're willing to show up. And then you also get people where they have a design that maybe hasn't quite crystallized yet, and they're playtesting and they're learning about how other people are making games and how other games are being developed so that they can hone their skills so that they feel confident when they're ready to take the step into designing their own game.
So, would you say that it's more people then that are just curious about designing games, or I know I was talking to someone yesterday. this is a fact. I was talking to Alex from CloudCap Games yesterday, and he was saying that a lot of people just like being in the ground floor of the process, like pulling the levers and all that. Like, so that, would you say there's a mix of people, or it's just
there's
more people who are designed?
Yeah, there's definitely a mix. I would say that we lean more towards designers than pure playtesters. At the local events, it's a little different. We tend to get more playtesters than pure designers, but especially for the digital, the online events, those tend to have a lot of folks who are primarily designers. But there's enough, when you have enough designers, everybody's game gets tested and everybody gets to level up their skills.
How many designers or like a hobbyist that created their own game would you say you usually get?
For the in-person events, we normally get about 3 to 4 designers, and then we typically get about 5 to 6 folks who are just interested in playing. They're either designers who don't have the next edition of their game ready, the next version of their game ready to test, but they're still showing up and they're helping to contribute, or you just get folks who are interested in trying out and getting in on the ground floor, like you said, and seeing how the hobby is developing. For the online playtesting, I think it is... the ones I attend... tend to be about 12 to 16 designers. It varies. So you get a lot of folks and maybe 0 to 1 people who are just there to play test.
Oh man, I just lost my question. This is great.
Well, I got a question.
Do it.
Yeah. How does the online play testing work? Is these more like online board games, or how do you play test online?
So I'm going to name drop a couple of services. People use Tabletop Playground with Break My Game, which is somewhat similar to Tabletop Simulator. It's got a little bit easier to work with and it's a little bit easier to design, but you can make your own essentially version of your board game in that tool. Another tool that I strongly recommend is ScreenTop. ScreenTop is a free online tool that works with your browser. If your game doesn't involve like 3D components or distance measuring, it's really useful. If it's just sort of a standard card tile cardboard game, you can make a version of your game in ScreenTop, and then you can just send the link to people and then they can play it with you just through their web browser.
So this was my question.
Like
when you have a prototype show up, like what sort of range in standards, because I feel like you know, much like many board gamers, I started designing something of my own and I just felt miserable about the look of it. I was pulling like Lego pieces in and like drawing on cardboard and stuff. Like, what sort of expectation is there for presentation on the table?
I would say that the Lego and cardboard post-it note card stage, we see games with that, and I think that that's a really good stage to start playtesting and prototyping in, because the farther along you get with your design, the more it costs, the more effort and the more energy that you're spending, even if you're not spending like dollars out of your wallet. But you want to make sure that the core of your game is solid before you get something printed. You know, speaking from personal experience, when I was a young designer, before I met Break My Game, I got like a 200 card, like big board thing. I invested in getting the art assets. I printed it. I brought it, and the game just didn't work, and it was miserable. So getting it in front of people when it's at the post-it note Lego stage, I think, is really important. And then you can kind of iterate up. Generally, we don't tend to see at Break My Game very polished final art assets, but that's mostly because of the way that design and the kind of next level getting your game sold works, where for a lot of publishers, if you're trying to get your game published, they have their own pool of art assets that they're going to be using. They have their own kind of look and feel. It's important that your design not have any graphical elements or UX elements that are distracting from the play of the game, and you have elements that are helping people to understand what they need to do. But at the same time, you don't want to spend a whole bunch of money, a whole bunch of time, a whole bunch of effort making everything look beautiful. If you're going to turn around, you're going to sell it to a publisher, and then the publisher is going to replace all of your hard work with their own set of assets.
Great. We're going to do a quick reset, and we'll be right back. So you're listening to 90.7 KBOO Portland. If you're just tuning in, I'm Nate, here with James, and this is Winner's Bias, a show about the board gaming hobby. We're talking to Ned Damon of Break My Games, and we're talking about designing and playtesting board games.
So if someone wanted to take a step into creating their own game,
yeah,
after playing many, many board games, because I'm assuming you would need to have a wide range of idea of board games,
yeah,
what would be a good fight? What would advice you have for them, for like a good first step?
So I think the very first step is to try and just dump out the whole idea of your game. So there's two kind of design methodologies that I see a lot. And I'm going to borrow from Mark Rosewater here a little bit, where you've got the sort of bottom-up designs and you've got top-down designs. So the top-down designs are, I want to simulate this thing interests me. So like, for example, I want to make a game about the gold rush. I want to make a game about space fighters shooting at each other. I want to make a game about trading in the Mediterranean, right? That's the kind of top-down design. On the other end, you have the bottom-up design where there's a mechanic or there's a way of interacting with the game that you start off with, and then you try and iterate off of that mechanic to try and find something that feels really good. But in both of these cases, what you want to do is you want to try and get the minimum viable game, the smallest version of your game that works and kind of encapsulates all the core mechanics. You want to try and get that into a physical or a digital version that people can play, and then you want to get that in front of at least one other human being to validate that your idea makes sense and that there's kind of a core of fun in it. And if there's not that core of fun, that's okay. You don't have to abandon your idea. You just have to look back and you have to see what didn't work, what wasn't contributing towards what you're going for. Some anti-advice I'd give for designers, things not to do. If you've got like a idea for a trading card game or something that involves like a huge number of components, don't make all of the components. If you've got like an idea for a game that uses 300 unique cards, don't make 300 unique cards. You will drive yourself absolutely insane. Make 20 cards and see if you can have a fun game with 20 cards. To reference like Magic the Gathering or other card games of that type, the core of Magic the Gathering of like vanilla creatures bumping into each other is enough of a game that you're making interesting decisions that you don't have to make the entire like 1,000 card set of your dreams. Just make sure that bumping creatures into each other is fun. Make sure that people are making interesting decisions with whatever the smallest viable unit of your game is.
Yeah, I've often heard that even starting like, hey, don't make your big opus your first game. Like, start with a card game that's going to be like maybe a standard deck of cards thickness or something like that. So it's just like something sort of easier to get yourself going with.
Yeah. Again, speaking from personal experience, the first game that I designed didn't get anywhere. It was this big opus space opera on a colony ship negotiation political game. And boy, I spent like a year and a half on that I will never get back. But I learned a lot.
I think creatures bumping into each other is my new favorite way to explain Magic the Gathering now.
So what is the goal for the play testers? Like, I know this is James' language here. Maybe James should even be asking the question. But like in video games, you have people that are like basically hired to just try to find all the glitches and find everything. Like, is that what playtesters are doing? Are they trying to, like, literally break the game and find every flaw with it?
I don't think that that's true. I think that for a lot of games, particularly for early prototype games, the flaws will become apparent after like a round or two of play. If there is an obvious degenerate strategy, if there's an obvious way that the game is not functioning, you will learn what's going on. You'll learn how to interact with that, and you'll very quickly understand why this thing isn't working. It's not people who are looking to try and find these little niche corner cases. But I will say that for playtesters, I think that a lot of folks, you get enjoyment out of playing new games. You get to see, like, every month, every week, depending on what kind of an event you're going to, you get a completely different set of games that are of all different genres, of all different types, and you get to experience them and see how they grow and develop and change. And it's really, it's a lot of fun. It can be a lot of fun. That said, playing the games frequently as a playtester is not going to be fun because the games aren't guaranteed to be fun yet.
So, like, that's the other thing I always think about this is, like, the games aren't guaranteed to be fun.
They're not.
So these people are giving their time that, I don't know about them, but my time is, like, I have limited time for playing games. And, like, playing it to be guaranteed, to not have a, like, guaranteed decent time, like this game just might not work altogether. It just seems like this is overstating a little, but it seems a little selfless to just be like, yeah, my time is better spent helping you than for my own actual guaranteed enjoyment of something.
I would say that's why a lot of the people who show up to these events are people who have their own games to design, why we have the rule that you have to give more than you take. So if you plan on having other people play your game to give that selflessly, you're expected to give back to the community to donate. And that's true at all the different levels of help that we give throughout Break My Game. So for example, if you have a rule book, we have a way that you can submit your rule book and get other people to look at that. But there's a requirement that you look at other people's rule books before other people look at your rule book. There's a pitch video section where if you're getting ready to pitch to developers, publishers, if you're getting ready to pitch to a contest like the Ion Awards or Cardboard Edison, people will watch your pitch video and they'll give you really good feedback, but there's an expectation and it's enforced that you are going to, you know, donate some of your time back to other people and you are going to look at their stuff.
So going back to the video game analogy, I've heard that people say if you are part of the Q&A and you have to find the breaking parts of games, it kind of ruins video games for them a lot. You go into it thinking that it's going to be amazing, you're working video games, but then it destroys your love for it. Has that ever happened, like, a little bit to you, where you're just like, I've played so many of this type of game that doesn't work, I can't do it anymore?
I definitely have that to a certain extent. I didn't really love this genre of game to begin with, but I'm a little bit burnt out about, like, semi-cooperative adventure games where you're, like, exploring a space station or fighting monsters in a dungeon or those kinds of things, where you see a lot of them and they tend to have very similar decision points and they tend to have very similar kind of places that they break down. And so I'm not as enthusiastic about those games, but I am committed to the overall, like, growth of the hobby, and I will enthusiastically play those games and give the designers honest, actionable feedback in as positive a tone as I can support about how you can make the best gosh darn, like, fighting aliens on a spaceship game that you possibly can.
So you had mentioned rule books earlier, and that's, like, a whole different beast I hear constantly. Like, the designer should not write their own rule book, is what I hear, because they're too close to it. But what about, like, blind playtesting? Do you do a lot of that? Because, you know, not having the designer being able to answer all the questions seems very valuable.
Yeah, so we do blind playtesting. There is an expectation that your game is a certain level of development along before you do blind playtesting, because blind playtesting, if we're talking about, like, the chance of fun, blind playtesting has the lowest odds of the people who are doing it successfully having fun within the time that they're allocated. Because, like you said, it's hard for the designer, it's hard for the person who has been so involved with the game to write the rule book. But a big part of being able to sell the game to publishers, a big part of being able to enter contests, about even just being able to intelligently explain the game, involves making sure that the rules work on their own without you being there to tell them, because you can't be included in every box of your game. And if you're not able to explain the rules in a way that makes sense when read, then something needs to change about your game. And so to go back to the idea of blind playtesting, we do allow for blind playtesting. We encourage people to have their other people look at the rule book first. We want to make sure that your game's been tested a couple of times before you try to do a blind playtest. But we do encourage blind playtests. I did a blind playtest of my game Rex Regnat a little bit ago, and I learned a huge amount about all the things that I thought were completely trivial but turned out to be amazingly confusing to somebody who was just given the box and the rule book.
So, just for the people listening, because obviously I know and we all know,
yeah.
What is a blind playtest?
In a blind playtest, either you give the box, including the rule book, to the person and you walk away, or you give it to them, and then you have to sit very quietly and not say anything as they try and follow the rules and actually play the game. So this is simulating as much as possible the experience of somebody, you know, buying the game at the game store. They sit down with it, they open up the box, and then they have to actually play the game. And that's tough. I think for a lot of people, having like a YouTube how to play video or having somebody who already knows how to play the game explain it to them is helpful. But those only happen once your game gets to a certain level of popularity, and your game is not going to get to a certain level of popularity if people can't just play it out of the box.
So, speaking of popularity, yeah. Have you seen any games come through, get produced, even in small print runs?
Yes.
Or, like, anything notable coming through, Break My Game?
I mean, again, to name drop, I believe Wingspan was originally a Break My Game game. Matthew Hawker's Lily Hop is being published soon. Their Positano, Jeff's Positano has been signed. We've had a fair few games come through. I think it's been a pretty even split between self-published games and publisher-published games, but we have certainly seen successes from both spaces, and it's great. I think that it's really wonderful because the people, once you get published, it's not like you leave the community. You stay involved with the community and you help people. It's kind of like a bodhisattva thing where you may have achieved enlightenment, but you're remaining on the mortal plane to help out folks who are still struggling.
Yep. I have one quick question.
Yeah.
I don't know how much time we have, but I wanted to ask about Kickstarter and how much that has affected this area of making your games.
We're kind of past peak Kickstarter, where there was definitely a period a couple of years ago where people were jumping very aggressively into Kickstarter with games that maybe hadn't gotten all of the polish and all of the scrutiny that they needed because Kickstarter was being very successful about getting games funded. And then I think there were a couple of pretty big troubles with games where either the game didn't get released in a timely fashion or there was the particular issues with some publishers essentially running a semi-Ponzi scheme where they were using the proceeds of the current Kickstarter to be able to pay off and actually produce the prior Kickstarter game. And so we definitely have gotten a lot of benefit from Kickstarter about your ability to self-publish, but you have to be rigorous about it, and you really need to do the same kinds of checks and safety and understanding that you would if you were trying to sell the game to a publisher.
All right, thank you. That's about all the time we have for today, so thank you so much, Ned, for being here. Really appreciate it. And thank you all for listening to Winner's Bias. If you would like to comment on the show, have any questions, or suggest discussion topics, you can email us at winnersbias@kboo.org, and you can find us on Instagram at Winner's Bias. I'm Nate.
And I'm James. We want to remind you that KBOO is a volunteer-powered community platform. That means we are funded by you, the listener. If you enjoyed the program today, please consider showing your support by making a donation. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. And remember, it's not about the games you play, but how you break the game along the way. Have a good one. Games people play now.